Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Today's number is 9.6 trillion. That is the estimated turnover of the, or on a daily basis rather, of the amount of forex that changes hands throughout the world as of April of last year. Increased from the $7.5 trillion level that it was at several years ago back in 2022. So almost $10 trillion worth of foreign exchange currency trades hands on a daily basis. I'm Jimmy Muyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest developments out of the Dangote Group. The business known as Dangote Petroleum is weighing up its listing options, with a primary listing set to be taking place in Nigeria at some point, but also potentially a secondary listing could be on the cards for markets like South Africa, Kenya, and other markets on the African continent. We speak to the chair of the Gas Economy Leadership Group at South African Oil and Gas Alliance, Craig Morkel, around that, and get his thoughts on how it is that that listing could affect the market in Africa, or the markets rather, in Africa. We also have a conversation with independent energy analyst Tsepo Gadima around the megacities in Africa and how it is that we can be powering these megacities with renewable resources. We have a conversation with the director of the Center of Public Policy and African Studies at the University of Johannesburg, Professor Busani Ngaweni, on the latest developments out of the Public Investment Corporation. That's something we've been keeping an eye on for quite some time, and it looks as though, as we reported yesterday, that confirmation of the reinstatement of the chief executive officer has gone ahead and been confirmed by the Minister of Finance as well. We're going to take a look at that and see what that means for the PIC. We also have a conversation with Frank Blackmore of KPMG to get his thoughts around South Africa's appeal to the United States to be exempted from certain tariffs following that labor investigation that the United States was holding into more than 40 countries, South Africa being amongst those countries. And because it's Wednesday, we have an executive lounge conversation to be had. We're going to be speaking to Thanda Kamgoma of Bridgestone, getting to know her a little bit better beyond her daily responsibilities.
The day's markets. Clear insights on today's winners, losers, and what to do next.
As always, that's where we kick off the show, with a sense of market movements that have been taking place throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Otto 1890's David Shapiro to take a look at markets and see what we make of them. Uncle David, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for the time. Markets were in the red, largely, almost exclusively, if we look at industrials and financials, but that made absolutely no difference because resource stocks pulled the entire JSE up today.
Incredible. You know, Jimmy, just very briefly, if we look at where we were last week when we were talking, the S&P was something like 7316 or something like that. It's 6% higher in 1 week. And that whole wall of worry that we had to worry about, you know, the AI overspend, oil price trade, all of that's gone. And suddenly markets are roaring ahead on the back of lower oil prices and also the AI results that came out. We'll talk about that. But how's that translated? Where I'm getting to is that with a lower oil price or peace, what does that mean? Lower oil prices equals lower interest rates. Lower interest rates equals, number one, reduced cost of holding gold. So what happens? Gold price goes up, and that gives us a strong JSE. I mean, it was all gold. It was not even platinum at its run yesterday, but very, very strong mining segment today. And then also with the reduced rates, number two, that reduces the appeal of the dollar. Dollar goes down, rand steady, strong. So I think those are the drivers in the market today. But big, big day for gold shares as well. And gold, I think, above 4,200 again, you know, which there was threats of it falling below 4,000, but there seems to be quite a bit of buying coming in against the backdrop that we've just painted now. So big day for the JSE.
Uncle David, let's take a look at those AI stocks that you touched on in the US.
Yeah.
We are in the thick of reporting season. We know that SpaceX gave us an update yesterday on their numbers from an earnings perspective. I want to get your thoughts on that number in particular, but also on the other numbers that we've been getting out of the US at the moment.
I think the one thing, if you had to just summarize it, They were all very good in absolute terms. In other words, the numbers, the amount of cash that they're making is incredible. And what I get out of that is the take up, the absorption, adoption into of AI, into business today. And I think that's going to grow and that's going to drive us ahead. A lot of the concerns about overspend, I think, have been allayed by actually seeing what's out there and how this is going to impact our lives. Not everything was the same. In Apple, they had issues with chip prices and also there with supply. Meta disappointed in terms of their outlook, but generally it's been a very, very good quarter for that. And so I think that's the bigger. SpaceX came out. I just find this very appealing. I just think because it's literally something we haven't got, this is outer space. And even though the numbers, I think generally the revenue came in okay. And you've got to look at it on what it does. They are going into space. They're still losing a bit of money there, but they're getting revenue, for putting satellites into orbit. But the other one is Starlink, which is getting stronger and stronger. It's still a small business, but growing in number of people that are using it. So I think also getting good revenue. And then the AI take up, which is also exceeding expectations, even though they've only got two major clients, Anthropic and Google. But they're providing cloud and they're providing computing power and that. So I'm interested, Jimmy, because they've knocked this price all the way back, and the analysts still. I was going through reports now. You've still got analysts projecting a 1 year target price of, 240, 250. There's some at 150, but there are others even beyond that 250. So I'm saying if analysts feel so optimistic about it and the price is now 110 or thereabouts, I think your downside's limited. I know there are a lot of stocks coming on. So I'm looking more from a fund point of view. And I mean, it's a good company and saying, okay, this could be an opportunity. Just to participate in something that we haven't really got, mainly Starlink, mainly the in space.
Uncle David, you mentioned that prices were coming back, and as you mentioned that, I had a quick look at the dollar index that has been trading below 100 points this entire week. One would think peace talks would potentially spark a bit of confidence in the US dollar or in the strength of the dollar. We've seen it trade above 101 points. I want to get your thoughts on it being back below 100 and perhaps the market still not entirely convinced that this is the end of the war.
No, with Trump, you never know, and I'm being honest, we don't know. The market seems to think that, that there's going to be some kind of deal, opening up the Straits of Hormuz. That's all they've spoken about. They haven't spoken about a peace deal. It's just shipping. So Trump keeps appearing. I see him on my screens all the time, saying we're waiting for Wednesday, Wednesday a deal and something's imminent and so on. We don't know the content, but you look to the oil market for some kind of guidance. It was down a little bit today. Look, it's still a not in comfortable area. We want it below 60. We want it in those areas, and you're still 80-ish, and anything, as we saw last week, it can spark to 90, literally in a minute or two. So don't it's still a something that we have to watch very, very carefully. But for the meantime, the market's saying something will come out of this. Yep. So, and look, that helps the rand as well. That's why I'm saying lower oil prices, and you see the equation. You can see how markets respond.
Absolutely. The rand is performing exceptionally well at the moment, especially against the US dollar. Uncle David, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the US markets just dipping into negative territory at the moment. Just before you and I came on air, the Nasdaq was down about 0.5%, S&P down about 0.1%. But as you alluded to quite rightly, up more than 5% if we look at this time last week. Markets are having those fluctuations, but it does seem as though the general bullish uptrend continues.
It will. We've got to. What happens? It can come all the way back to the last high, which was 77, what, 09 or 7609. That's still a few hundred points, but you're going to get profit taking, certainly after yesterday's move, massive. It might even just have a bit of profit taking midday, in the US lunchtime, and then kind of pick up more momentum as we close. But that's I think it's entirely expected in that. But there's still quite a few features in the US. So listen, we're a better place than we were last week. So, quite happy.
Absolutely, a better place than we were last week, and we will take that win because it seems as though they are few and far between these days. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Otto 1890's David Shapiro joining us to take a look at markets and some of the movements we've been seeing throughout the day and some of the positives.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As you'll remember, yesterday we got the latest in the updates from the Public Investment Corporation, the court ruling that the suspension of this chief executive officer in Patrick Dlamini was declared invalid. Following that, immediately we got a confirmation of his reinstatement as chief executive officer of the PIC. We've been keeping an eye on this story, and we have previously had this conversation with Professor Busani Ngaweni of the Center for Public Policy and African Studies at the Johannesburg Business School. He joins me on the line now once again to take a look at this development, see what to make of it. Prof, lovely having you back on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Quite the surprising turn of events considering where we were the last time you and I spoke. What do you make of these developments?
Well, actually, it is not surprising. And that is because one has read two pieces of documents that are very crucial for that suspension saga. The first was the PIC Act, which is very explicit in terms of defining who is the employer at the PIC, and it defines it as being the minister in consultation with cabinet. The role of the board, of course, is to recommend a suitable candidate, and the minister in consultation with cabinet makes the appointment. Therefore, it is established in law that he who employs also is the one who has the power to suspend or to fire. And second, in terms of the delegation of authority of the PIC, which is a document that is available, it is very explicit in terms of what happens when the CEO must be suspended or disciplined, that it is the HR committee of the board that must make a recommendation, which must then be supported. And in this instance, both of these provisions were not followed, which is why, therefore, I am arguing that this decision was not surprising.
Prof, where do we go to from here? How do we move forward now that the chief executive officer has been reinstated? There is still the conversation of that whistleblower report that was put out. There is still the conversation of some of the ongoing matters that the previous PIC board chair in Dr. David Masondo explicitly said should be dealt with and not swept under the rug. Do we continue with business as usual at the PIC? Is it possible to continue in that light?
No. In fact, it will not be advisable to do so. So what the decision of the court says is that the CEO is reinstated because the CEO suspension was not procedural. But it does not mean that his retention or his reinstatement now suspends other allegations. So, for example, the board that is now been appointed because of the new board may still decide to follow due process to act on that whistleblower report, even if it means they must effect a suspension. So that remains a possibility. They just need to follow the steps, as I said, in the PIC Act, as well as in the delegation of authority that is available to regulate the governance of the organization. So that's the first thing. So the board may choose to do exactly that, this new board. But in addition to that, there is some cursory reference to the issue of the whistleblower and all the provisions that are available. And the board may choose to follow the provisions available to the documents and the regulations of the PIC Act to act on it. Because you cannot say, now that we are reinstated because we are suspended unprocedurally, therefore it means it suspends what was contained in the whistleblower report. So that has to go its full course using the due process that is provided for in the organization. But this is the most important part of the question you are asking. Where to from here? Even if these issues were cleared by the board or by the court today, there is a bigger issue around the transformation of the PIC to a point where it can be governed effectively and it can also operate efficiently. We now know that there are problems with the governance of the organization and how it operates, to the extent that we have people who think that they can borrow money and not pay it back, or they can borrow money and pay less than what they are obliged to, or to the extent that you think that there are people who think they will call a specific individual if their application is not being processed, then there is a problem. There are some very useful recommendations from the Mphathe report which need to be implemented, including the organizational restructuring of the PIC, and that ought to be implemented. You cannot have such an important organization in the economy of the country and in the lives of the pensioners who hold their resources in trust at the PIC being condemned by about 5%, less than 10% of the business of the PIC. So there's got to be a reimagination. And this principle is important for the PIC, but it is as much significant for all other SOEs in the Republic of South Africa. We cannot have an institution that are operating the same way they were operating 15, 20 years ago, when the market conditions have changed, when the fiscal conditions have changed, when the public expectations have also changed. All other countries that have got SOE portfolios like South Africa, they engage in the processes of reimagining, of reforming governance and operations of these SOEs over a period of time. And some of our very important institutions have not done so. And therefore, the board has a very important responsibility of reimagining. Lastly, this board must ensure that it is properly inducted. We know that there are men and women there who have distinguished themselves in various professions. However, it is significant that a board must be properly inducted, because even if you're a chief pilot of a particular airline, when you join a different airline which may be using a different brand, you have to return to the simulator, because if you were flying a Boeing 747, it does not automatically qualify you to now fly an Airbus aircraft. You have to return to the simulator. Therefore, this board has to be effectively inducted. They must deal with issues of governance, issues of conflicts of interest, issues of understanding how to take the mandate of the organization forward, and be very clear about what they will achieve as a collective, so that they don't suffer the fate of the board preceding the current one appointed by Cabinet last week.
Much still needs to be done at the Public Investment Corporation if we are to reimagine this particular asset manager, especially given that it is the custodian of 3.6 odd trillion rands of civil servants' pension funds. We're going to have to leave the conversation on that note. Professor Busani Ngaweni of the Center for Public Policy and African Studies at Johannesburg Business School joining us to reflect on the reinstatement of the PIC's CEO.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm at Land of Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount Rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo,
the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Conversations about energy security continue on the African continent, and as part of these conversations, the team at Bloomberg NEF have put together quite an interesting market outlook for the sub-Saharan region on the African continent regarding clean energy and the clean energy market. This report suggests that the sub-Saharan area of the African continent expects to install almost 30 gigawatts of solar, wind and battery capacity by 2030, which is significantly higher than the current 13 gigawatts that was reported as of last year. We're going to be looking at this in a bit more detail with independent energy analyst Tsepo Radima, who joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Radima, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. You and I have spoken about energy mix conversations. We've spoken about ensuring that we have the optimal mix for the South African situation and the South African economy. But the broader African conversation seems to be following suit, and we seem to be seeing a greater transition towards renewables.
Rabuha, good evening as well as to the listeners. Yes, you're right. We are going to see a continued growth in the behind-the-meter off-grid energy installations driven largely by solar. But that at the same time, I think it does not bode well for a established or long-established entity like Eskom, which currently is being broken up. So if anything, this trend is going to accelerate the demise of Eskom itself. But within the continent, I think we're going to see perhaps maybe even a doubling of the projected capacity of 29 gigawatts, purely because Africa doesn't have energy, or sub-Saharan Africa. And also, we are seeing that the capital markets, largely from the United States, are starting to look at energy as an investable asset class in sub-Saharan Africa. So certainly, I think we are going to see an acceleration. But for South Africa, it doesn't bode well, because for years I've been warning about the impending exodus, which is now has gathered pace. And that exodus is led not because of energy poverty, but is led by the high tariffs, which have become certainly unsustainably higher.
Radima, can we take a look at how it is that we navigate the conversations of things like microgrids, especially if we look at something like the megacity trends that we're seeing? We're starting to see a greater focus on establishing megacity type setups on the African continent, whether we're looking at special economic zones, whether we're looking at infrastructure development. These megacities that we hope to create require and demand a greater level of power. How then do we start to balance infrastructure development needs with the right energy mix for that infrastructure development?
Well, infrastructure and largely energy is going to be the key driver for, you know, behind those smart city new developments that are there. So certainly it speaks to the growing demand, but that growing demand is not going to be on grid. Now, South Africa has adopted a policy of attempting to, you know, place intermittent energy on the grid. And that certainly is, I mean, the results are well known. And I think the so-called Transmission Company of South Africa, or the National Transmission Company of South Africa, is already on record lamenting the rate of what they call curtailment, which simply means that power you dump because you can't use it anywhere else. But within the continent, we are going to see adoption of behind the meter off grid, but hybrid in the sense that light current appliances will largely be driven by a solar panel with a battery, whereas energy intensive usage appliances such as stoves, heating, and otherwise, those will be largely be driven on gas. And so we're going to see investment increasing also in the area of natural gas, liquefied petroleum gas, as well as biogas production and supply, in order to enable that hybrid energy mix, if I can use that term, even though it's not really, you know, elegant to say an energy mix. But effectively, you're going to have a hybrid solution whereby, you know, you've got solar off-grid, and then, of course, with gas, whatever form of gas is there, being the anchor of ensuring that there is usage. Now, if you look at those companies, or those countries rather, together with their companies that are advocating for the so-called wheeling agreements or placing intermittent energy on the grid, such as Plant for South Africa, whereby the new National Transmission Company of South Africa is forced to not only purchase this 100% redundant power from the so-called renewables, but at the same time they are about to embark on an unprecedented grid expansion at a whopping 440 billion rand budget, which of course will have cost overruns. So in the end, you'll end up with over 700 billion rand. But I don't think that they'll even get to spend that. I believe that we are going to see private sector-led investment going on off-grid behind-the-meter installations, and therefore the planned 14,000-kilometer grid expansion is a stillborn. But overall, it can only be good. I think what is missing from the policymakers is how then we take advantage of this unprecedented energy demand for Africa and ensure that most of the original equipment is actually fabricated, engineered, manufactured, and therefore installed in Africa instead of importing, because that is going to have other pressures, largely on central bankers who will have to find foreign currency to be able to import those materials.
Certainly a lot needs to be looked at if we are to get the right, as Regadima refers to it, hybrid energy mix, for lack of a better term. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Thanks as always to resident energy expert, independent energy analyst Tsepo Regadima, for joining us to take a look at how it is that we can leverage renewables in advancing the overall development of sub-Saharan Africa.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
So several weeks ago, we floated the idea that the business known as Dangote Petroleum was potentially looking at listing. At the time, we were looking at listing on the London Stock Exchange. We've since received some new intel that potentially suggests that Nigeria's stock exchange could be the destination for the primary listing, with markets like Kenya and South Africa in the running for potentially a secondary listing, or even just benefiting from the primary listing. We're going to try and make sense of this as it stands at the moment, and we're going to see if we can try and figure out what an IPO of this size could potentially mean for the African continent. I'm joined on the line by the chairperson of the South African Oil and Gas Alliance's Gas Economy Leadership Group, Craig Morkel, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Craig, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. This could potentially be the largest IPO that the African continent has seen. I mean, early estimates on valuation put the Dangote Petroleum business at potentially around $40 billion in valuation based on a private stake that was dealt with a couple of weeks ago. But we know that at least $5 billion could potentially be coming to market via this IPO. Tell us about the significance of this IPO.
Jimmy, thank you so much. And to your listeners, this is a lot bigger than merely an IPO. We shouldn't look at this as investor confidence in only Dangote industries. It is a potential vote of confidence in Africa and its industrialization through energy infrastructure such as a refinery. And if they are successful in their IPO, then it should be encouraged, because then we will have an opportunity to attract not only foreign direct investment, but continental direct investment. And by that I mean pension funds such as those in South Africa. And hopefully then Mr. Dangote would consider listing on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange as well, right? But it is significant in that it would be an investment of that scale, would be globally significant, and it would help us to deal with supply chain disruptions that could be caused by global pandemics, by regional conflicts such as the Strait of Hormuz. And the closer supply is to demand, the less the risk and the lower the cost of transport in particular. So this is a particularly interesting asset class. It is not simply a refinery. It is investable infrastructure that Africa desperately needs and should therefore be encouraged. It would demonstrate confidence in Africa's industrial capability at a scale that we've never seen before. And should they go to Kenya and build a refinery there, it would certainly help with security of supply in not only East Africa, but every interconnecting piece of infrastructure, including road and rail, from Kenya into the hinterland, even southward towards South Africa.
Craig, you mentioned something quite important. You use the term investable infrastructure, and we know that South Africa has been on its own investment drives around infrastructure development, with the government committing at least R1 trillion towards infrastructure development. But I want to look at that in a bit more detail. Investable infrastructure means then that infrastructure that would have some investment case for it. What does that mean for the African continent in terms of significance? Because we know that the continent is in dire need of infrastructure investment. We have seen it in certain parts, in certain economies, but this kind of IPO represents the potential for a blueprint on what investable infrastructure could look like, as you allude to.
Yes, Jimmy, we're talking about a going concern here. We're not talking about a new kid on the block. And that counts for something. A going concern that has generated revenue, that has the potential to generate further revenue, is very attractive whether it's listed or not. And you mentioned earlier the 6% acquisition by an investor does then signify that a valuation is at least attached to that kind of asset that's already a going concern. That bodes well. That bodes well. But I need to declare one concern. You know, we haven't seen the books because it's a private company. We will certainly, with an IPO, see the books. And any investor, institutional or other, will, I'm sure, conduct a thorough due diligence before they commit. And so I encourage Dangote Group to please just get its paperwork right, so that it could then please pass those kinds of due diligence requirements of any investor. And I don't think Mr. Dangote is ignorant of that. He is able to attract investors before and should know this very clearly. So I think it's a going concern that could expand. And a greenfield project in Kenya would not be as scary as one might think, because they have existing demand there. And so you could simply do a price comparison. Can a refinery in Kenya deliver product cheaper than the imported cost? So we're not talking about plastic goods and clothing that could be imported from the cheapest manufacturer in the world here. We're talking about something that can be a raw material in Africa, can become an intermediate or intermediary product, and can then also become a final product. And we sometimes forget how much of our lives are intertwined with the oil and gas value chain, given that so many petrochemical products used in the most basic of things rely on oil and or gas. And this helps us to make that transition from dirtier, unhealthier options, such as coal and biomass, where we're sitting with 600 million Africans without clean energy. And by that, I mean cleaner than dung, right? This changes that map completely, because now people could have access to energy in a more dignified way, in a more consistent way. And hopefully the 1% contribution of Africa to global warming through its greenhouse gas emissions will not increase too much. We still have room. We have not really been responsible for global warming, but we need to grow. And so growing our emissions from 1% of global to perhaps 3% of global should not raise any eyebrows anywhere. And I mention that in particular because some institutional investors have a challenge investing in any form of fossil fuel. And I would urge them to reconsider that position, especially whilst we are still in a transition, that they should consider what a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions would mean relative to the status quo. So as long as there is a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions towards a country's nationally determined commitment, it might be net zero by 2050, others may have it at 2060. But as long as there is a consistent reduction over time, we can survive the transition. But if we make any sudden changes, any quick moves that we are not prepared for, then we could experience what has happened elsewhere in the world, where the transition has perhaps happened too fast and they have suffered the consequences, including blackouts, including market price spikes, electricity market, gas market spikes, because of an overdependence on intermittent technologies without first putting in place the protective measures that you need to avoid the intermittency challenge and its impact on grid stability and therefore energy security.
A story of energy security and, more importantly, of investable infrastructure on the African continent. The Dangote Petroleum Refinery and Petrochemicals business intending to list on the Nigerian Stock Exchange and perhaps on more than one exchange. That IPO marking a significant milestone for Africa's development, Africa's capital markets, and how it is that Africa becomes even more investable. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Chairperson of the South African Oil and Gas Alliance's Gas Economy Leadership Group, Craig Morkel, joining us to take a look at the impending IPO of Dangote Petroleum.
Did you know, recent rain does not always mean your soil is at field water capacity? Omnia can help determine plant available water, giving producers a view of their planting risk profile. It's one more way Soil Insight helps reduce production risk. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
The United States has previously been investigating more than 60 countries, particularly the United States Trade Representative under Section 301 of their Trade Act, was investigating concerns around forced labor practices. And following from that investigation, we covered obviously the submissions that were made by South Africa as one of the countries identified there towards the latter part of the month of July. We now know that South Africa has been given a 12.5% tariff that will be imposed as a result of the findings of this particular investigation. However, the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition locally has written to the United States to potentially have that 12.5% exempted. We're going to be digging into this in a bit more detail with lead economist at KPMG, Frank Blackmore. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Frank, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The 12.5% relative to perhaps some of the other countries, the other 60 countries that were identified there, is that the best case scenario South Africa could have come out of that investigation with?
I think probably initially. So either you got the 12.5 or you got the 10%. And the majority are two-thirds, about 41 countries, I think, ended up with the 12.5. And the rest with the 10%. But of course, like you said in your introduction, we are trying to appeal it. We are trying to get ourselves exempt from this tariff based on the fact that, you know, we have legislation that's supposed to protect against forced labor as well as the importation of goods produced by forced labor. So it's again sort of the, we've seen this before in Liberation Day tariffs where they throw a number at you and then you're meant to negotiate and work your way towards a more sustainable type of solution here. And there's a lot of speculation that all these tariffs are, given the breadth of them, 60 countries covering about 99% of the imports into the US, which is basically everything, are just a substitute for those Liberation Day tariffs, which the US Supreme Court found were illegal because the president didn't have those powers to put those tariffs on the countries. So people are just saying they found another law by which to enforce these tariffs on the market.
Now, Frank, this law has already been challenged in the United States, not just by the countries, but rather by the Democrat lawmakers that have taken the Trump administration to court, describing these particular sets of tariffs under Section 301 as unlawful as well. That, in and of itself, is quite telling, considering, as you mentioned, what took place around the Liberation Day tariffs. Where do we sit from a South African perspective around understanding the implications of these tariffs? Because the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition has made it very clear that they are still open to bilateral conversations with the United States. So they're taking the tariffs quite seriously. But where does that leave us as South Africa?
Look, I think we're taking these more seriously than we did, than we took the Liberation Day tariffs. In fact, the reaction was quite sudden. We sent over a delegation to request exemption of those tariffs. We took part in public hearings in Washington last month where we stated the same, which was basically that we had already the relevant legislation in place to prohibit forced labor practices, both within South Africa in our production processes, but also that prohibited the importation of goods used by this. Because, you know, one of the underlying factors, I guess, when you're talking about this combating forced labor in global supply chains, to me, there's a lot of code here saying what you're really trying to do is to find, from an economic reason, is to deter exports from countries that outcompete the US, i.e., China, probably mostly. We know a lot of countries, especially in Africa, are doing a lot of business with China, and this is one way also to intervene there and say, you know, those practices may not be sort of free and regulated as in the rest of the world, and therefore they're finding this as an in. In that respect. And we're doing all we can in this respect. As I said, we've gone over, we've taken a delegation, we've putting information before these guys. We have been at that sort of that the hearing in Washington, etc. And it is a diplomatic solution. That's all that's available to us at this point. And as you mentioned, internally within the US, they're also going against these tariffs for the same basic reason as the previous tariffs, that, you know, there wasn't consultation, they were done randomly, they're too broad, etc. And so we see where that lands.
Frank, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts around where it is that we land from a South African perspective. We have been exploring alternative markets. We have heard that the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, in the Minister, Park Stau, has confirmed that the United States is still a critical part of South African trade relationships. And we've also seen that the United States has always prioritized their own interest as they have above those of perhaps any other country at this stage. Is there an alternative here if we are not able to see eye to eye on this tariff imposition?
Well, you know, there are a number of ways to look at this thing. One is you can't keep running away from people that give you a bad deal because you end up cornering yourself in some small number of countries globally. We need the diversification. We need the trade with the US. It's not easy negotiating with these guys at the moment. But I think we should, as the minister has said, keep these relations. They do form a quite a large proportion of our, you know, of our economic trade, around, you know, 9%, just under China, 10 or 11%. And then the bigger blocks that we've developed in trade. Sub-Saharan Africa is about 25%, and then Europe is the largest at about 27% still. So we're well diversified, and we want to keep that diversification. So I think we should continue to obviously try and negotiate a better deal with these guys. And what we saw from the Liberation Day tariffs, you know, one of the requests that we made to the government here is just exemption of specific sectors, as we saw last time as well, things like platinum, precious metals, vehicles, fruit, so citrus mainly and nuts, arguing that there's no evidence that these exports are being produced currently, you know, from South Africa with forced labor. We can prove that, you know. So, you know, it's also in the U.S.'s interest, and we saw in Liberation Day tariffs, a lot of those categories that I've just mentioned, the tariffs were dropped from that because it was a disadvantage to the U.S. to keep those tariffs on when they needed things like, you know, precious metals, critical minerals, and even pressure from fruit and veg, where their people were saying, you know, we can't get fresh citrus in out of season. And they dropped those tariffs as well on us. So I think a lot of this is set up for negotiating a better deal.
Interestingly enough, those are some of the areas that the minister in the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition outlined as well, around platinum, precious metals, citrus, wine and nuts as areas that particularly should be exempted from this tariff. We'll see how this develops and where it is that we end up by the end of this. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Lead economist at KPMG, Frank Blackmore, joining us to take a look at the latest implications of the labor tariffs that the US has imposed on South Africa.
I'm Nobukhanya Mtambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Executive Lounge, where top leaders share their business insights and life lessons on SAFM.
This week's executive is the sales director at Bridgestone EMEA, Thandeka Ngoma. She joins me on the line now to get to know her a little bit better. Thandeka, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. How did you end up at Bridgestone?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, so my journey into Bridgestone actually, you know, I suppose it reflects on my entire career journey. I started out in financial services back a few years ago, without giving out my age. And then from there, I actually sort of fell in love with marketing when I moved into FMCG at a company called Procter & Gamble, which was an amazing school for any young marketer. It's a great training ground. And then in my journey, I also worked for Philips, where I got a little bit of experience working outside into other African markets. And with that comes just learning different business models and learning different cultures and how to operate in different environments. And that then eventually led me to Bridgestone, where I made the leap into the tire industry, which was very different, of course, from anything that I'd done before. But I also ventured into the dark side of sales, as I call it, when I was at Bridgestone, which has been an amazing experience.
Thandeka, how did you know that for you sales and marketing were more exciting than financial services? I mean, surely coming into that role, you didn't know that that's what you were looking forward to. And with your experience at Procter & Gamble, your experience working at Philips as well, how did you kind of settle on, oh, okay, this is what my passion is?
Yeah, look, I think with marketing, it was almost like falling in love, literally, as in I stumbled onto it. I did a little bit of marketing as a second major when I was at university from 1999. And I kind of enjoyed it, but when I really got to experience it in real life, it was really like falling in love. And so that was like finding my passion. But sales is so different from marketing, actually. And that was more a case of stretching myself outside of my comfort zone. It was like battling with myself around, you know, do I really want to do this? It's so different. It's outside of my comfort zone. What are people going to say? What if I fail? All of these things were questions that were running in my mind about 6 years ago when I decided to shift into, you know, leading the sales organization at Bridgestone. And so in the end, I decided, what will happen if I move? I will learn. Even if I fail, I will still learn and I will be a better marketer for it if I choose that, if I decide and realize that this is not actually something that works for me. And so in the end, it was really a case of saying, let me make the leap and see if I like it. If I don't, then I learned a lesson. But what if I do like it, which is actually what has happened. It has stretched me into an area of growth, leading such, you know, big teams of people, engaging with so many customers, and really being able to influence a much, much bigger pool of stakeholders than anything that I've experienced before.
Thandeka, you touched on the growth that you've been able to realize and the growth you've been able to achieve. What has forced you, or what lesson has forced you to push yourself beyond what you thought might be a personal boundary that you could, or a personal limitation that you could couldn't overcome?
You know what? I think as leaders, some of the things that, at least personally, that I've experienced is that it's so helpful to surround yourself with people that will mentor you, with people that can sponsor you even, you know. For me, I was so fortunate that I had the right mentor, you know, through my leadership journey, somebody that can basically say, "You look, push you in some cases. In some cases, they just give you perspective and share a little bit of their experiences. But sponsors would play a very different role. And I haven't had many of those, actually, but I've had one at a very critical point in my career when I was at Bridgestone. And these are the people that get to talk about you when you are not in the room. These are the people who, you know, believe in your capability even before you have, sort of shown how much more you can do. They see something in you and they say, I'm just going to back this person. When something comes up as an opportunity, I will put them forward, you know, in these rooms. And I think it's very important to surround ourselves with these kinds of people in our lives that will encourage us, that will open doors for us, because sometimes you just need an opportunity. And for me, I was very fortunate to have that. And I suppose it's linked with just the general drive that, you know, people have, that I personally had around achieving, around winning. It's one of my, you know, goals in life. It's just, I love to win. It's naturally ingrained in me. I always want to win. And so with all of that and backed up by the right kind of people, I find myself where I am today, which is a very, impactful position where I get to influence people and really live out my purpose, which is amazing to get paid to do that every single day.
Finding a way to win and living out your purpose at the exact same time, isn't that the dream that we all ascribe to? We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Thandeka Ngoma, Sales Director at Bridgestone EMEA, it's been lovely getting to know you a little bit better. Thank you for being part of our Executive Lounge.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And just like that, folks, that is the update for today. We will continue to keep an eye on some of the market developments. We are, as I mentioned earlier, keeping abreast of what is happening from an earnings perspective in the US. Yesterday, we did get those SpaceX numbers alongside the Berkshire Hathaway numbers that have come through as well. Walt Disney, Shopify, Western Digital, all the companies we know quite well have been providing us with an update on their performances, and we'll keep giving you a sense of how those performances influence some of the market movements. For now, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hose is standing by with the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.